Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of Western adventure, ranging from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading The Virginian by Owen Wister. Chapter 10, Where Fancy Was Spread. Two camps in the open and the Virginian's Monty horse, untired, brought him to the Swintons in good time for the barbecue. The horse received good food at length, while his rider was welcomed with good whiskey. Good whiskey, for had not steers jumped to 75? Inside the Goose Egg kitchen, many small delicacies were preparing, and a steer was roasting whole outside. The bed of flame under it showed steadily brighter against the dusk that was beginning to veil the lowlands. The busy hosts went and came, while men stood and men lay near the fire glow. Chalkeye was there, and Nebraska, and Trampas, and Honey Wiggin, with others enjoying the occasion. But Honey Wiggin was enjoying himself. He had an audience. He was sitting up discoursing to it. "Hello," he said, perceiving the Virginian. "So you dropped in for your turn. Number six, ain't he, boys?"
"Depends on who's a-running the countin'," said the Virginian, and stretched himself down among the audience.
"I've saw him number one when nobody else was around," said Trampas.
"How far away was you standin' when you beheld that?" inquired the lounging Southerner.
"Well, boys," said Wiggin, "I expect it will be Miss Schoolmarm says who's number one tonight."
"So she's arrived in this here country?" observed the Virginian very casually.
"Arrived," said Trampas again. "Where have you been grazing lately?"
"Oh, right smart way from the mules."
"Nebraska and the boys was telling me they missed you off the range again," interposed Wiggin. "Say, Nebraska, who have you offered your canary to the schoolmarm said you mustn't give her?"
Nebraska grinned wretchedly.
"Well, she's a lady, and she's square, not taking a man's gift when she don't take the man. But you'd ought to get back all them letters you wrote her. You sure ought to ask her for them telltales." "Aw, pshaw, honey," protested the youth. It was well known that he could not write his name. "Why, if here ain't Bouquet Baldy," cried the agile Wiggin, stooping to fresh prey. "Found them slippers yet, Baldy? Tell you, boys, that was terrible sad luck Baldy had. Did you hear about that? Baldy, you know, he can stay on a tame horse most as well as the schoolmarm, but you just give him a pair of young knitting needles and see him make 'em sweat. He worked an elegant pair of slippers with pink cabbages on 'em from Miss Wood."
"I bought 'em at Medicine Bow," blundered Baldy.
"So you did," assented the skillful comedian. "Baldy, he bought 'em, and on the road to her cabin there at the tailor's, he got to thinking they might be too big, and he got to studying what to do, and he fixed up to tell her about his not being sure of the size, and how she was to let him know if they dropped off her, and he'd exchange 'em. And when he got right near her door, why, he couldn't find his courage. And so he slips the parcel under the fence and starts serenading her. But she ain't inside her cabin at all. She's at supper next door with the tailors. And Baldy singing 'Love has conquered pride and anger' to a lone house. Lynn McLean was coming up by Taylor's Corral, where Taylor's Texas Bull was. Well, it was terrible sad. Baldy's pants got tore, but he fell inside the fence, and Lynn drove the bull back, and somebody stole them Medicine Bow galoshes. You gonna knit her some more, Bouquet?"
"About half that ain't straight," Baldy commented with mildness.
"The half that was tore off your pants? Well, never mind, Baldy. Lynn will get left too, same as all of you."
"Is there many?"
inquired the Virginian. He was still stretched on his back, looking up at the sky. "I don't know how many she's been used to where she was raised," Wiggin answered. "A kid stage driver come from Point of Rocks one day, went back the next. Then the foreman of the 76 outfit, and the horse wrangler from the Bar Circle L, and two deputy marshals, with punchers stringing right along, all got their tumble. Old Judge Burridge from Cheyenne come up in August for a hunt and stayed round here and never hunted at all. And there was that horse thief. Awful good looking. Taylor wanted to warn her about him, but Mrs. Taylor said she'd look after her if it was needed. Mr. Horse Thief gave it up quicker than most, but the schoolmarm couldn't have knowed he had a Mrs. Horse Thief camped on Poison Spider till afterwards. She wouldn't go riding with him. She'll go with some, and taking a kid along.
Meh, said Trampas.
The Virginian stopped looking at the sky and watched Trampas from where he lay.
I think she encourages a man some, said poor Nebraska.
Encourages because she lets you teach her how to shoot, said Wiggin.
Well, I don't guess I'm a judge. I've always kind of kept away from them good women. Don't seem to think of anything to chat about to them. The only folks I'd say she encourages is the school kids. She kisses them.
"Riding and shooting and kissing the kids," sneered Trampas. "That's a heap too pussy kitten for me." They laughed. The sagebrush audience is readily cynical.
"Look for the man, I say," Trampas pursued. "And ain't he there? She leaves Baldy sit on the fence while she and Lynn McLean."
They laughed loudly at the blackguard picture which he drew, and the laugh stopped short. For the Virginian stood over Trampas.
"You can rise up now and tell them you lie," he said. The man was still for a moment in the dead silence.
"I thought you claimed you and her wasn't acquainted," said he then.
"Stand on your legs, you polecat, and say you're a liar."
Trampas's hand moved behind him.
"Quit that," said the Southerner,
"or I'll break your neck."
The eye of a man is the prince of deadly weapons. Trampas looked in the Virginian's and slowly rose.
"I didn't mean," he began and paused,
his face poisonously bloated.
"Well, I'll call that sufficient. Keep a standing still. I ain't going to trouble you long. In admitting yourself to be a liar, you have spoke God's truth for once. Honey Wiggin, you and me and the boys have hit town too frequent for any of us to play Sunday on the balance of the gang."
He stopped and surveyed public opinion, seated around in carefully inexpressive attention.
"We ain't a Christian outfit a little bit. Maybe we have most forgotten what decency feels like, but I reckon we haven't forgot what it means. You can sit down now if you want."
The liar stood and sneered experimentally, looking at public opinion. But this changeful deity was no longer with him, and he heard it variously assenting,
"That's so," and "She's a lady,"
and otherwise excellently moralizing, so he held his peace. When, however, the Virginian had departed to the roasting steer, and public opinion relaxed into that comfort which we all experience when the sermon ends, Trampas sat down amid the reviving cheerfulness and ventured again to be facetious.
"Shut your rank mouth," said Wiggin to him amiably. "I don't care whether he knows her or if he done it on principle. I'll accept the roundin' up he gave us. And say, you'll swallow your dose too. Us boys'll stand in with him in this."
So Trampas swallowed, and what of the Virginian? He had championed the feeble, and spoken honorably in meeting, and according to all the constitutions and bylaws of morality, he should have been walking in virtue's especial calm. But there it was. He had spoken. He had given them a peep through the keyhole at his inner man, and as he prowled away from the assemblage, before whom he stood convicted of decency, it was vicious rather than virtuous that he felt. Other matters also disquieted him. So, Lynn McLean was hanging around that schoolmarm, yet he joined Bill Swinton in a seemingly Christian spirit. He took some whiskey and praised the size of the barrel, speaking with his host like this.
There certainly aren't going to be trouble about a second helping.
Hope not. We ought to have more trimmings, though. We're shy on ducks.
Well, you have the barrel. Has Lynn McLean seen that?
No, we tried for ducks, way down as far as the Laparelle outfit. A real barbecue.
There's large thirsts on Bear Creek. Lynn McLean will pass on ducks.
Lynn's not thirsty this month.
Signed for 1 month, has he?
Signed? He's spooning our school marm.
The claim she's a right sweet-faced girl.
Yes, yes, awful agreeable, and next thing you're fooled clean through.
You don't say.
She keeps a-teaching the darn kids, and it seems like a good grown-up man can't interest her.
You don't say.
There used to be all the ducks you wanted at the Laparelle, but their fool cook's dead stuck on raising turkeys this year.
That must have been mighty close to a drowning the school marm got at South Fork.
Well, I guess not when. She's never spoken of any such thing that I've heard.
Most likely the stage driver got it wrong then.
Yes, he must have drowned somebody else.
Here they come. Now that's her riding the horse. There's the West Falls. Where are you running to?
To fix up. Got any soap round here?
Yes, shouted Swinton, for the Virginian was now some distance away. Towels and everything in the dugout.
And he went to welcome his first formal guest. The Virginian reached his saddle under a shed.
So, she never mentioned it,
said he, untying his slicker for the trousers and the scarf.
I didn't notice Lynn anywheres around her.
He was over in the dugout now, whipping off his overalls, and soon he was excellently clean and ready, except for the tie in his scarf and the part in his hair.
I'd have known her in Greenland, he remarked. He held the candle up and down at the looking glass,
and the looking glass up and down at his head.
It's mighty strange why she ain't mentioned that.
He worried the scarf a fold or two further, and at length, a trifle more than satisfied with his appearance, he proceeded most serenely toward the sound of the tuning fiddles. He passed through the storeroom behind the kitchen, stepping lightly lest he should rouse the 10 or 12 babies that lay on the table or beneath it. On Bear Creek, babies and children always went with their parents to a dance, because nurses were unknown. So little Alfred and Christopher lay there among the wraps, parallel and crosswise with little Taylors and little Carmody's and Lee's and all the Bear Creek offspring that was not yet able to skip at large and hamper its indulgent elders in the ballroom.
"Well, Lynn ain't here yet," said the Virginian, looking in upon the people.
There was Miss Wood, standing up for the quadrille.
"I didn't remember her hair was that pretty," said he. "But ain't she a little, little girl?"
Now she was, in truth, 5'3", but then he could look away down on the top of her head.
"Salute your honey!" called the first fiddler.
All partners bowed to each other, and as she turned, Miss Wood saw the man in the doorway. Again, as it had been at South Fork that day, his eyes dropped from hers, and she divined instantly why he had come after half a year, thought of the handkerchief and of that scream of hers in the river, and became filled with tyranny and anticipation, for indeed he was fine to look upon. So she danced away, carefully unaware of his existence.
"First Lady Center," said her partner, reminding her of her turn. "Have you forgotten how it goes since last time?"
Molly Wood did not forget again, but quadrilled with the most sprightly devotion.
"I see some new faces tonight," said she presently.
"You always do forget our poor faces," said her partner.
"Oh, no, there's a stranger now. Who is that black man?"
"Well, he's from Virginia, and he ain't allowing he's black."
"He's a tenderfoot, I suppose."
"Ah, that's rich."
And so the simple partner explained a great deal about the Virginian to Molly Wood.
At the end of the set, she saw the man by the door take a step in her direction.
"Oh," said she quickly to the partner, "how warm it is. I must see how those babies are doing."
And she passed the Virginian in a breeze of unconcern. His eyes gravely lingered where she had gone. "She knowed me right away," said he. He looked for a moment, then leaned against the door. "How warm it is," said she. "Well, it ain't so screeching hot here. And as for rushing after Alfred and Christopher when their natural mother's bumping around handy, she certainly can't be offended." He broke off and looked again where she had gone. And then Miss Wood passed him brightly again and was dancing the schottische almost immediately. "Oh, yes, she knows me," said the swarthy cowpuncher. "She has to take trouble not to see me, and what she a fussin' at is mighty interestin'." "Hello!"
"Hello,"
returned Lynn McLean sourly. He had just looked into the kitchen.
"Not dancing?" the southerner inquired.
"Don't know how."
"Had scarlet fever and forgot your past life?"
Lynn grinned.
"Better persuade the school mom to learn it. She's going to give me instruction."
"Huh,"
went Mr. McLean and skulked out to the barrel.
"Why, the claim you weren't drinking this month," said his friend, following. "Well, I am. Here's luck."
The two pledged in 10 cups.
"But I'm not waltzing with her," blurted Mr. McLean grievously. "She called me an exception."
"Waltzing," repeated the Virginian quickly, and hearing the fiddles, he hastened away. Few in Bear Creek County could waltz, and with these few it was mostly an unsteered and ponderous exhibition. Therefore was the southerner bent upon profiting by his skill. He entered the room, and his lady saw him come, where she sat alone for the moment, and her thoughts grew a little hurried.
"Will you try a turn, ma'am?"
"I beg your pardon?" It was a remote, well-schooled eye that she lifted now upon him.
"If you like a waltz, ma'am, will you waltz with me?"
"You're from Virginia, I understand," said Molly Wood, regarding him politely, but not rising. One gains authority immensely by keeping one's seat. All good teachers know this.
"Yes, ma'am, from Virginia."
"I've heard that southerners have such good manners."
"That's correct."
The cowpuncher flushed, but he spoke in his unvaryingly gentle voice. "For in New England, you know," pursued Miss Molly, noting his scarf and clean-shaven chin, and then again steadily meeting his eye, "gentlemen ask to be presented to ladies before they ask them to waltz." He stood a moment before her, deeper and deeper scarlet, and the more she saw his handsome face, the keener rose her excitement. She waited for him to speak of the river, for then she was going to be surprised and gradually to remember and finally to be very nice to him. But he did not wait.
"I ask your pardon, lady,"
said he, and bowing walked off, leaving her at once afraid that he might not come back. But she had altogether mistaken her man. Back he came serenely with Mr. Taylor, and was duly presented to her. Thus were the conventions vindicated. It can never be known what the cowpuncher was going to say next, for Uncle Huey stepped up with a glass of water which she had left Wood to bring, and asking for a turn, most graciously received it. She danced away from a situation where she began to feel herself getting the worst of it. One moment the Virginian stared at his lady as she lightly circulated, and then he went out to the barrel. "Leave him for Uncle Huey?" Jealousy is a deep and delicate thing, and works its spite in many ways. The Virginian had been ready to look at Lynn McLean with a hostile eye, but finding him now beside the barrel, he felt a brotherhood between himself and Lynn, and his hostility had taken a new and whimsical direction. "Here's how," said he to McLean, and they pledged each other in the tin cups.
"Been getting them instructions?" said Mr. McLean, grinning. "I thought I saw you learning your steps through the window."
"Here's your good health," said the Southerner. Once more they pledged each other handsomely.
"Did she call you an exception or anything?" said Lynn.
"Well, it would suffer out right close in that neighborhood."
"Here's how, then," cried delighted Lynn over his cup. "Just because you happen to come from Vermont," continued Mr. McLean, "is no cause for extra pride. Shoo, I was raised in Massachusetts myself, and big men have been raised there, too. Daniel Webster and Israel Putnam, a lot of them politicians."
"Virginia is a good little old state," observed the Southerner.
"Well, both of 'em's a sight ahead of Vermont. She told me I was the first exception she'd struck."
"What rule were you proving at the time, Lynn?"
"Well, you see, I started to kiss her."
"You did?"
"Shucks, I didn't mean nothing."
"I reckon you stopped mighty sudden."
"Why, I'd been riding out with her, riding to school, riding from school, coming in and going. She chatting cheerful, asking me a heap of questions all about myself every day. And I'm not lying much, neither. And so I figured she wouldn't mind. Lots of 'em like it. But she didn't, you bet."
"No," said the Virginian, deeply proud of his lady who had slighted him. He had pulled her out of the water once, and he had been her unrewarded knight even today, and he felt his grievance. But he spoke not of it to Lynn, for he felt also in memory her arms clinging around him as he carried her ashore upon his horse. But he muttered, "Plumb ridiculous," as her injustice struck him afresh, while the outraged McLean told his tale.
"Trample is what she's done on me tonight, and without notice. We were starting to come here. Taylor and Mrs. were ahead in the buggy, and I was holding her horse and helping her up in the saddle like I'd done for days and days. Who was there to see us? I figured she'd not mind, and she calls me an exception. Yeah, I've just heard her about Western men respecting women, so that's the last word we spoke."
"We come 25 miles, then she's scooting in front and her horse kicking the sand in my face. Mrs. Taylor, she guessed something was up, but she didn't tell."
"Miss Wood did not tell?"
"Not she. She'll never open her head. She can take care of herself, you bet."
The fiddle sounded hilariously in the house, and the feet also. They had warmed up altogether, and their dancing figures crossed the windows back and forth. The two cowpunchers drew near to a window and looked in gloomily.
"There she goes," said Lynn.
"With Uncle Huey again," said the Virginian sourly. "You might suppose he didn't have a wife and twins to see the way he goes gambling around."
"Westfall's taking a turn with her now," said McLean.
"James!" exclaimed the Virginian. "He's another with a wife and family, and he gets the dancing too."
"There she goes with Taylor," said Lynn presently.
"Another married man," the Southerner commented. They prowled around to the storeroom and passed through the kitchen to where the dancers were robustly tramping. Miss Wood was still the partner of Mr. Taylor.
"Let's have some whiskey," said the Virginian.
They had it, and returned, and the Virginian's disgust and sense of injury grew deeper.
"Old Carmody's got her now," he drawled. "He pokers like a landslide. She learns his monkey-faced kid to spell dog and cow all the morning. He'd ought to be tucked up cozy in his bed right now, old Carmody ought."
They were standing in that place, set apart for the sleeping children. And just at this moment, one of the two babies that were stowed beneath a chair uttered a drowsy note.
A much louder cry, indeed a chorus of lament, would have been needed to reach the ears of the parents in the room beyond. Such was the noisy volume of the dance. But in this quiet place, the light sound caught Mr. McLean's attention, and he turned to see if anything were wrong. But both babies were sleeping peacefully.
"Them's Uncle Huey's twins," he said.
"How do you happen to know that?" inquired the Virginian, suddenly interested.
"Saw his wife put him under the chair so she could find him right off when she come to go home."
"Oh," said the Virginian thoughtfully. "Oh, find him right off, yes. Uncle Huey's twins." He walked to a spot from which he could view the dance. "Well," he continued, returning, "the schoolmarm must have taken quite a notion to Uncle Huey. He's got her for this quadrille." The Virginian was now speaking without rancor, but his words came with a slightly augmented drawl, and this with him was often a bad omen. He now turned his eyes upon the collected babies wrapped in various colored shawls and knitted work. 9, 10, 11 beautiful sleeping strangers," he countered in a sweet voice. "Any of 'em yourn, Lynn?"
"Not that I know of," grinned Mr. McLean.
11, 12. This here is little Christopher in the blue striped quilt. Maybe that other yellow head is him. Angels have commenced to drop in on us right smart along Bear Creek, Lynn. What trash are you talking, anyway? If they look so awful alike in the heavenly garden," the gentle southerner continued, "I just hate to be the folks that has the cutting of them out of the general herd." "And that's a right quaint notion, too," he added softly. "Them under the chair, Uncle Huey's, didn't you tell me?" And stooping, he lifted the torpid babies and placed them beneath the table. "No, that ain't thorough," he murmured. With wonderful dexterity and solicitude for their welfare, he removed the loose wrap which was around them, and this soon led to an intricate process of exchange. For a moment, Mr. McLean had been staring at the Virginian, puzzled. Then, with a joyful yelp of enlightenment, he sprang to abet him. And while both busied themselves with the shawls and quilts, the unconscious parents went dancing vigorously on, and the small, occasional cries of their progeny did not reach them.
Join me next week on the Sagebrush Trail for more exciting adventures of the Virginian by Owen Wister.